Tears lowered their eyes.
Your daddy's gone to be a traveling salesman now. Now I'm here to keep things going.
I said, what about the butter making? Isn't he going to make butter anymore? Ms. Min looked at me. I don't think it occurred to her that we'd talk. She opened the kitchen door and spat her tobacco outside.
You hear me? Your daddy's a traveling salesman now. He'll be home at the end of the week. He's a drummer now.
She put her hands on her hips.
You're gonna mind me.
I walked to her room, trying to show gumption. The little girls followed me. They watched me dry myself off on the bottom of my mother's quilt, and they waited until I was done. It was still light out, but I took off my shoes and got into our bed, and the girls did the same. As vicious as Myrtle could be in her sleep, foot in your eye, elbow right in the kidney, I let her stay on my right side, her hair fanning over me, and Ruby curled up like a baby on my left, her fat little hands around my neck. We'd already lived through the dark night of my mother's stroke a week ago, coming right after laundry day, the worst day of the week, and as hot a wet hell as you can imagine. My father'd come into our bedroom late at night, pulling me out of our bed, telling me to hurry and get dressed, just like he had me walk to the store for flour or oats when we ran out, except that it was pitch dark, and he was talking in what we called his friendly way, meaning that he wasn't likely to pull a stave out of the butter keg and whip me or Rudy or Myrtle black and blue right then. He said, "Your mother's not well." He shoved me down the hall and opened the door to their room. I'd never been in their room when they were both in it. I helped my mother out, which I had to, with the basin and the pitcher and bringing her the commode. Twice, she got bronchitis. And last year, a neighbor lady sent us hog stew, and my mother got so sick on it, she puked until nothing more came up, and she still was twisting and turning on the floor. I helped, too, after Ruby was born. Helped my mother to get right and feed Ruby, because the visiting nurse had come and gone in no time. My mother lay back on the pillow, and I pulled her breast into the baby's mouth, rolling the milk down and squeezing and flicking Ruby's cheeks to suck. When Ruby and I were playing, and I was a little too rough on her, and she said, why was I doing her like that? Sometimes I said, I'm your true mama, and what I say goes. My father and I stood on either side of the bed in their small, hot room, the paper shade flapping against the one window. Her quilt was on the floor. He looked at my mother, and at me, and he pushed me toward the bed. Lorraine is here, he said. Her chest was heaving. Her gray, cracked feet kicked at nothing, but she did breathe. Her mouth opened, ragged and wet against the pillow, and spit ran out, wetting the ends of her gray braid. And I kept my eyes on the rattling shade and thought, you can beat me till hell freezes over and still, I'm not going to take care of her. Will not, no more than she took care of me these last years. My father beat us, but Ruby had sweetness, and Myrtle was little, and I was the oldest, so mostly me. When I played follow the leader with the two of them in the barn, and they slipped on the ladder and skinned their knees, I comforted them and thought, that's nothing to what I go through, and you do not. My mother lived for peace. When my father whipped our puppy for peeing on the rug, my mother covered her face with her apron until he was done, and she swept the puppy's body out to the ditch. When he slung our kitten against the side of the barn a full five times, my mother stood by the road with her hat and coat on, as if she were about to leave him. And she watched him toss its little gold body in the weeds. Ruby and I wrapped it up after school, in a scrap of crochet my mother handed me, finger on her lips, back of the kitchen, and I sang Blessed Assurance.
Blessed Assurance, Jesus is mine. Oh, what a foretaste of glory divine, heir of salvation, purchase of God, born of his spirit, washed in his blood.
And Ruby, who couldn't carry a tune in a bucket, belted it out beside me. Myrtle, who had more of my father than my mother in her, poked the dead cat with a stick, mumbling, until we'd sung all four verses and buried the little thing properly. We came back in, and my mother gave us molasses on bread heels, and she put her finger to her lips again, watching the road. My mother wanted peace when she was living, and peace when she was dying. She cried out, looking up at the ceiling, "Mother of God, let me go." I walked as far around her bed as I could, and opened the window to give her some air. I waved the shade to make a fan for her. I had to empty the commode and walk downstairs with it, my face pulled in from the black, terrible sea in the bowl, and the ugly shapes in it lapped up to the edge, and I tried to keep my fingers and shoes from being splashed with it. It stank, and I emptied it, and washed it out, and washed it again, and somehow the porcelain bowl still stank. Where I poured it out, nothing would grow. I washed my hands at the pump with a handful of borax. I moved as slow as I dared, back up the stairs to turn her over, trying to be careful of the purple bruises blossoming up and down her knobby spine, to flip the sheet, to close the window now that dust was coming onto her, to give her some water from the teacup, and clean up when she couldn't keep even the water down. I moved too slow, and she rose a little and grabbed my sleeve. "Oh, Jesus, it hurts," she said, and fell back, pulling on me until I was down beside her on the bed. I wiggled toward the floor, away from the stink, and she put her hand in my hair and held on. "Ain't you got the curls?" she said. She gasped and I sat up. She gasped again and let go. "Never mind," she said. "You scared?" I was scared. I tried not to inhale, to not catch what she had. She would die, and I would die next. My mother turned her face away from the window. The shade was broken. I hung one of her dresses over the rod. She nodded. She yawned, and I said, hopefully, "You tired, Mama? You want to take a little rest?" She shook her head and yawned again, and I could see into her mouth, her thick tongue, her bright red gums, the spaces where she'd lost her teeth. "Have a baby, lose a tooth," everyone said. She stank to high heaven, and I went to open the window. Her eyes rolled back in her head, and she opened her mouth wide, the veins in her neck popping, as if to scream, and she settled down suddenly, easing into the pillow. A little blood ran out of her mouth, and I ran down the stairs, running over Ruby, who grabbed at my legs, kicking Myrtle to one side. My father'd slept on the kitchen floor with two blankets under his back, and the rocker cushion for a pillow, and he left them in a pile. I saw him by the fence and ran over. I told him Mother was bleeding out of her mouth. He asked if she was still talking, and I said that we just spoke a minute ago. "She ain't dying then. You go back up. Wipe her mouth with water. Folks get dry." He took a drink from his flask and handed it over. "You can give her this." I didn't ask when he would come upstairs, or when could I stop sitting with her. I spooned out whiskey for her until the flask was empty. "Pa says you ain't dying," I said. She lifted her chin. I pulled the sheet up to her shoulders and she pushed it away, wincing. "I'm gonna go," I said. "Just downstairs." She waved her hand sideways. I slept in until the sunlight beat on my face. The little girls were scattered out of the house. My father was in the kitchen with the minister and an older lady. "Lorena," my father said, and I bobbed down to show respect. The minister said, "Shall we pray?" And my father let his head drop forward, like an old horse waiting for the bit. And I did the same. The minister said, "Jesus and our Lord," and he said my mother's name. He said, "Anna Hickok, mother of Lorena, Rose, and Myrtle, beloved wife of Addison Hickok." And that's how I knew. I could hear the girls playing down the road. I sighed, and my father tightened his grip on my hand, and rubbed my knuckle bones together to warn me. The minister's voice died down, and I said, I ought to look after the girls, and I broke away. I went down by the fence. Ruby was still crying, and Myrtle was her usual wild dog self. It's gonna be all right, I said. Not, it will not, Myrtle said. I put Ruby up on my shoulder and dragged Myrtle down the path. We sat in the barn, napping in the shade and playing hopscotch with an old horseshoe until it was almost dark. I figured whichever neighbors could put something together would be bringing us a bread or a chess pie or some potato and beans before nightfall. I was right, and the four of us sat down and ate dinner like we hadn't had in a year, and my father didn't smack anyone's hand away from anything. Ruby said, God bless Mama, and the three of us nodded. That was my mother's funeral. My father came home the last Friday in August, and the tight salesman suit and the greasy celluloid collar Miss Min made him buy. The suit made him look cheap, which he was, and dishonest, which he was not in the business way. He set his brown bowler on the sideboard and his wrinkled jacket on the back of the rocker, and he stretched his neck from side to side. He nodded to Ms. Min. She dusted off a chair for him and told us to sit by her. My father said that Ruby was going to live with an uncle on my mother's side in Wisconsin. Good people, he said, and Ms. Min shrugged. She didn't give a fiddler's fuck if they were good people or not. Ruby was the sweet and pretty one, my father's favorite, if he had one, and to have her gone would be a relief for Ms. Min, I think. Myrtle was hell on 2 feet, but she was sly and only 6, and they'd keep Myrtle with them for a while longer, until she gave them cause. I was stubborn trouble at home, and almost a woman. I had a nice singing voice, and when things weren't too bad, my father took me to church and sat in the front pew, like a paying customer, he said, and made sure I got a solo. I could see the way Ms. Min would see it. My father got down a cardboard box from his closet and said that there were people in town, plenty of them, looking for a hired girl. $1 a week, he said, maybe more, plus meals. Not too bad, and you can keep going to school. He said that surely I could clean a house, and we both snorted because I never did a lick of housework after my mother got sick, and he knew it. He beat me every day the week before she passed, and all it got him was shrunken trousers and stew so salty and soapy, he let us put it in a pan behind the house and watch to see what kind of brave gophers might come for it. I didn't think Ms. Min would have let us watch what happened to the stew. She gave Myrtle a little tap on the fanny to show that Myrtle needed to be minding Ms. Min for real now. And she said to me that since the three of them would be moving on, she advised me to do the same. She said, if you can help it, don't clump around and smile. People like it when a girl smiles. I went into her room and my father followed me in. He put a cardboard box on the bed. This is for your things, he said. He put in my mother's hairbrush. Use it, he said. I folded up every bit of clothing I had, my mother's shoes, and the last of her Lily of the Valley soap, which she'd used sliver by sliver since I was a little girl. I hugged Ruby hard, and we hid our faces in each other's shoulders, trying not to give way. I waved to Myrtle, who lifted her hand. My father walked me to the door and opened it. I walked down the road and around the first bend to where they couldn't see me. I knew this road like a conductor knows the tracks. It was past 6 o'clock on a Friday night in August. The sky was still bright blue, the edge of the trees just a hair darker. Town traffic was done. Farmers were done. I could have stood or slept right in the middle of the road and never seen a soul. I slept under a cottonwood and woke up with my arms around my box. I had nowhere to go but Lottie Miller's house, 4 miles away. Lottie was the other smart girl in our school. We sat together at lunch for 3 years in a row. I got to sit with Lottie for 20 minutes at a time, holding her hand, breathing her in. Once I saw I could get my foot in the door with Lottie, I made a real effort. I brushed my hair and chewed mint on the way to school. Her mother sometimes came by to walk her home from school, and I always gave her a big hello, Mrs. Miller, and she smiled. Lottie's father was one of the shopkeepers who used to yell at Myrtle. I spit on my shirt sleeve to wipe my face and dragged the hairbrush through my hair. I tied it all back with my hair ribbon, and I hoped that even if I looked like a fool or a hobo, my wish to please the Millers would please them. I sat on the Miller's back porch for about an hour, until I saw Lottie's mother moving around the kitchen in her house dress. She gasped when she saw me. She managed, without being unkind, to get me to rinse off in the hip bath while she stood guard at the back door. She asked me if my mother and father knew where I was, and I told her that my father had told me to go get a job, and my mother died 3 weeks ago. I smiled at every question to show how willing and pleasant I was. I should have hidden myself under the piece of linen Lottie's mother handed me, but there was a breeze. It came through the back door, touching me on my chest and neck and between my legs. Water ran from my hair down my back to my feet. I shook my hair so it sprayed water around me. It was heaven. I had never been lovely in all my conscious life, but I knew right then, standing barefoot on the rag rug on top of the linoleum, that I was clean and young and damp, and that that was a kind of lovely. Lottie's mother turned her back right away. I patted myself dry slowly, feeling my skin through the old sheet. I dried my toes and all of my parts. I held the sheet like a shawl and shimmied it up and down my back. I put on my only underclothes and my blue blouse and my better skirt and my mother's shoes. I could see Mrs. Miller had hoped that a decent bath and doing my hair in braids would make me more like Lottie. I had hoped so, too. I knew we had a problem. I ate on the back porch at supper so as not to disturb Mr. Miller, who worked long hours. I put myself fully in the hands of Mrs. Miller, just to pretend that I was a girl like Lottie, floating along in a loving stream, cared for and watched over. I prayed that Lottie's mother might take me in. I left no crumbs. I cleaned my shoes every day. I only drank water, and I never asked for seconds, so no one would think I'd be any kind of burden on the Miller household. In the evenings, I swept out the kitchen and sat on the back porch, still as a bucket, waiting until Lottie gave me the high sign to run up to her room. I was 13 years old, and if I was going to hell or the poorhouse or was forced to sell myself in downtown Pierre, like one of the older girls at school had said could happen, I was going to have a holiday first. Lottie and I read poetry aloud. We found Mrs. Miller's Ouija board in the attic, and I made it say that I would go far, and Lottie would marry a rich and handsome fellow. I teased Lottie about her future husband, hoping it might lead us to playing honeymoon, which we'd played before, on a rainy afternoon, when the road to my house was washing out and Rose and Myrtle had stayed with our teacher. We were getting ready for honeymoon, Lottie with a pillowcase over her head, like a scarf to signify train travel, and me, the groom, with a cardigan buttoned over my blouse. Lottie's mother came in and stood in the doorway. She said we were too loud, and I was banished to the sleeping porch. I folded up the quilt every morning and swept the porch, too, to show some more of my goodness. On the fourth day of the only holiday I'd ever had, Lottie's mother woke me up early. Mr. Miller had already gone, and Lottie was still sleeping. She took my hand and brought me into her bedroom. She gave me a white slip and one of her own dresses. She brushed my hair and clipped it back with a pair of enamel slides. which was pretty much tying a ribbon on a side of beef. But I let her. She gave me a pair of Lottie's embroidered anklets, and we both tried to make something of my mother's shoes, which were close to falling apart.
I wish we wore the same size, she said. Honest to goodness, I'd give you my own.
I know you would, I said. You're the kindest person I've ever known. Ain't nobody like you.
Isn't.
Lottie's mother sighed.
Thank you.
When Eleanor woke up, I said that I could tell her my story now, if she wanted, and she said she did. I said we'd been poor most of my life. We had 2 good years in Wisconsin, I said, but I don't remember them very well. And even worse, we were poor in South Dakota. I said that my father had been brutal to me and my sisters, and that my mother died when I was 13, and I had nursed her best I could.
It must have meant so much to your mother, having you there, Eleanor said.
I hope so. I told her that I'd lost track of my 2 little sisters, and I told her a funny story about me and Ruby making kites out of newspapers when we were little. I told her about playing Uncle Tom's Cabin, and I told her I'd worked as a hired girl for a while, mopping the floor and burning the brownies. I told her about Mrs. Miller's kindness. Not much of a housekeeper, I said.
Nor am I, she said. I wasn't raised to do it. I must say, I admire women who have domestic skills.
I said I admired people who could kill, skin, and cook a rabbit, but I didn't want to do what they did. Eleanor patted my shoulder and walked out of our compartment. She came back wearing a fresh blouse and fresh lipstick. My daughter makes me, she said, carrying a tray of coffee, orange juice, and rolls. Eleanor said that she'd meet Missy and go with her to the funeral. You needn't, she said, meaning I shouldn't. I thought I could write a pretty hot story about the governor's wife and mistress attending the funeral of the mistress's mother, but then I'd have no more Eleanor and no ride home. I said I'd find myself a diner and sit there until the 5 o'clock train whistled. We parted at the station, and I watched her go. To this day, I love a diner. I tucked $2 under the sugar bowl, so the one waitress, a tall, pretty redhead with freckles head to foot, would pour me coffee all day. At lunchtime, a few salesmen came in, and at 3 o'clock, we got some mothers and their lucky, well-fed children. A dark, chunky girl and a slim, ratty blonde sat in the booth in front of me, sharing a moxie, folding their straw wrappers into a chain. The blonde said if she never cleaned another toilet again, it'd be too soon. The dark girl sighed, and they slipped off their shoes. My people. The hired girls. I didn't tell Eleanor much. I didn't tell her that I had cried into my sleeve when Mrs. Miller brought me to the gate of a good-sized house. We will all miss you, she said, but this really is a decent job, and you can still go to school. She had smoothed back my hair one more time, and she kissed me on the forehead, which I felt for days after. I told her straight out that I wasn't up to snuff, that I'd done my best to fool her with the sweeping and wiping my shoes, but I had never done laundry beyond diapers, or made a meal, or looked after anyone except Ruby and Myrtle, and what I'd done with them wasn't exactly a recommendation. Lottie's mother looked to the right and the left, and she whispered that it was no matter. The O'Neills couldn't get anyone better because of their papish ways. There was a small Catholic church 50 miles away, and the Klan had ridden through a few of the bigger towns, is what I heard. But I hadn't heard that anyone had burned a cross in front of the church or hurt the people at the Chinese laundry. And still, the reason the O'Neills would take me was that the better class of hired girl, neat, pleasant, cheerful, good with a peeler and a dust mop, wouldn't work for Irish people. I couldn't do a goddamn thing but make porridge and wash a baby's diapers until they didn't stink. And still, they would have me. $1 a week. The O'Neills were easy. They were not nicer than Mrs. Miller, who I see now was a motivated seller, but they were filled with confidence and enough money from where I stood, and they loved each other, which astonished me. The first time Charlie O'Neill raised his hand to his wife, I flinched. He tucked a brown-edged daisy from the yard behind her ear, and she kissed his hand. There, little girl, giddy with all the love, pressed her face to Mrs. O'Neill's breast, and I thought, oh, who are you people? I loved them, the way girls today love their movie stars. I got up early to make breakfast for little Lucille and for baby Brendan. Mrs. O'Neill came down to supervise, looking tousled and charming, like a Gibson girl at dawn. I fed the kids and cleaned the baby's diaper. I scoured the pot and ran out the door to school, eating my toast or Brendan's teething biscuit. When Miss West dismissed us, I tore ass back to the O'Neills to get dinner started and keep up with the diapers. Sometimes, Lottie ran part of the way with me, and when I turned off for the O'Neills, she waved warmly, and I waved back, hard as I could. Lottie was too kind to take up entirely with another girl, but I did see her look with interest at Addie Long at lunchtime. I was, just as I'd said, not much good as a hired girl. It turned out that I was good enough company for Mrs. O'Neill. She was from far off Boston, which accounted for her odd accent and her occasional cigarette, even though she was not a bad woman. She told me that, one October afternoon, while she leafed through a magazine and I rocked both the kids. I laughed and I told her that smoking a cigarette was not my idea of a bad woman. She said that she was surprised that a young girl like me had any idea of what a bad woman even was. I said, oh, I did, for sure, and she shook her head. I'll get some rest myself, she said, and left me rocking the baby carriage in the bassinet, in the shade. I washed her intimate things, I cleaned her baby's bottoms, and I scrubbed every dirty thing I came across. I didn't do any of it well, but I made an effort, as Mrs. O'Neill often said, and it was better than having to live in Bodle, South Dakota, and clean house all day herself. I used to be a secretary, she said. I was bathing the kids in the hip bath, in the kitchen, letting the baby blow bubbles and letting Lucille splash all over. Mrs. O'Neill was keeping an eye on us and making remarks about the magazine recipe for brownies and whether or not either one of us could produce a tray of them with her temperamental oven. We both heard the knock on the front door. It was low class for her to answer the door herself, but I was soaked and barefoot, and that was worse. She looked at my feet and went to the door. I laid the baby on the wet floor and put on my socks and shoes. I pushed back my hair and dried my face and hands. I heard my father's voice, and I sat down on the floor with Lucille and baby Brennan in my lap. Mrs. O'Neill came in, and her voice shook a little. She never had a man in the house without Mr. O'Neill around, and I knew she'd never met a man like my father. I left your father in the parlor, she said. No, ma'am, my father said, right behind her. He looked down at the naked babies and me, and I wrapped them both up and handed them to Mrs. O'Neill, who stood beside me. Mrs. O'Neill was a pretty Boston rosebud, and she would not be saving me from Addison Hickok. Lorena is like a member of the family, she said. She's such a help. My father nodded. He said it was best that I move with him and Myrtle and Ms. Min to Aberdeen. He said whatever I was doing for this family, I could do for another. He said they was starting over in Aberdeen and could use my wages. To Mrs. O'Neill, he said, thank you for putting up with Lorena. I stood in my little room until he called my name. I got my cardboard box and went back to the kitchen, where Mrs. O'Neill gave me a hug and pressed 50 cents into my hand on the sly. The two kids waved goodbye from the floor. On the way up the door, I stole a stamp from Mr. O'Neill's desk to send a note to Ruby in Wisconsin about us heading for Aberdeen, which I did never get to. Mizmin was waiting with the wagon, and Myrtle lay in the back, sprawled across two suitcases. I climbed in the back, and Myrtle kicked at me to keep me from getting comfortable. As it was getting dark, we pulled up in front of an old farm. Men were sitting on benches in the front, and smoke curled up from their pipes and a small campfire. My father said, "This here's your stop. I'll hold on to your pay." Mizmin didn't say a word, and Myrtle stuck out her tongue. It was the last time I ever saw her. An old lady opened the door. "I'm Mrs. Cotter. You're Lorena. Your father says you can cook. You'll be the cook," she said. "I guess so," I said. I saw Mrs. Cotter take my measure, raw-boned and broad-shouldered in a made-over dress. People had been sizing me up for a year. They'd been looking hard. "You don't look sneaky," she said. "No, ma'am, I'm a straight shooter." "Well, what choice do you have?" she said. "Looking like you do." She tossed me a couple of peanuts from an open sack on the floor. "I'll pay $1 a week and you can sleep in the kitchen. And no nocturnal visitation, you know what I'm saying?" "I'm not expecting any visitors," I said. I slept on a bedroll in the kitchen, cooking for the threshers for 3 weeks. All the farmers had got together to hire threshers. Two boys my age had come to the threshing with their uncle. They said the settling up at the end was usually more of a party than anything else. The men sat at long tables, drinking, and the farmers with single daughters made small talk with the men who stood out as hard workers.
"It's a big party," Bernie said. "You can get yourself a husband."
His brother laughed, and so did I.
"You can get yourself a beer," Jim said.
It was bad weather for weeks, and the settling up seemed likely to never come. The farmers' wives and daughters were cooking overtime. I was blistered and dirty with burns striped to my elbow. I learned how to cook for a crowd. The boys sat by the fire with me most nights while I lay down near the stove because my feet couldn't take it anymore. Bernie said he'd heard that this settling up was going to be ugly. He said it didn't look like payday was going to come for them. I said their uncle didn't seem to be looking out for them, and Bernie said, "Uncle my white ass." Bernie said that they might hitch a ride out on the lumber wagon when it came by tomorrow before breakfast. Jim said, "Hell yes they might," and he showed me a red wool sock with $3 silver in it.
"Come on, Hick," Bernie said. "Come with. Ain't nothing good gonna happen to you here."
I stretched out on the floor, not minding the soot or the embers. I was almighty tired, and I was as dirty as the boys.
"Go on, take something," Jim said. "We'll be lookout."
I crept down the hall to the old man's desk. I gathered myself. I wiped my hands on my skirt and went drawer by drawer through his big oak desk. I found a little drawer shaped like a cube and running the whole of the desk from front to back, hidden under a pretty square of bird's eye maple. I held up $2 silver and the boys whooped quietly. I felt that great tide inside, danger and joy rising and falling, and I grabbed Mrs. Cotter's gray felt church hat and their best bread knife and put them both in my cardboard box. The boys and I walked down to the bend, and we waited until the lumber wagon came in, and then drove out, slowing a bit as it came to the cottonwood we hid behind. The lumberman said,
"So, three of you, not two.
That's another dollar." The boys looked at me, and I gave the man one of my dollars. We rode, like brothers and sister, to the train station, and the boys shook my hand. They lit out for better times in Oregon, and I made up my mind, as we stood in the train yard, that it was me for Chicago, with jobs and schools and my mother's sister, my Aunt Ella. The train men called, and I held on to my box and my ticket. I fixed the gray hat so I could pass for 16. My father ran onto the train, sweating and hatless, yelling at me to come back and do my job. Come run the house. He said Mrs. Cotter told him I'd run off, and he said I was on the road to ruin. I stayed in my seat. He said he'd washed his hands of me. I said that we were even, that I washed my hands of him too. It should have been that he admired my spine and my spunk, but he slapped me across the face and knocked my new hat off. I pressed myself against the window, gripping the box so hard I put my fingers through it and felt the knife handle. I wrapped my fingers around it and let him see. One couple looked at me, and I mimed drinking from a bottle, and they shook their heads, and I thought, you people will not see me dragged off this train. I held on to the wicker seat until the train began to move, and my father jumped off. Eleanor fell asleep in Oneida. At dawn, she kissed me on the forehead. You are a wonderful storyteller, she said. She left me to wash up and came back armored in another fresh blouse and a stiff blue jacket. Like Boadicea, I said, showing off, Queen of the Iceni.
Oh, yes, she said. Great warrior. Go on with the story.
She fixed my collar.
And do spruce up a little, Eleanor said.
Churchill said, to me, in fact, criticism is like pain. It's not fun, but if it doesn't hurt, no one pays attention. Brother and sister in one body. I said to Eleanor, my own education began on the train to Chicago. I described the short man in a loud checked suit, walking past me, his manicured hand brushing the back of my seat, steadying himself, and rolling with the train. He pushed back his boater and patted his face with a white handkerchief. He said, Ladies and gentlemen, I am Lucius P. Wilson. He gave his ballyhoo, and I loved every long, unlikely, and ridiculous sentence. He said, Let me introduce you to the 7th, 8th, and 9th wonders of the world. You may not have expected to find us here in Lake Preston and Plankton and Groton and Brookings, making our magnificent way to Minnesota. By golly, land of 1,000 lakes, land of beautiful Indian maidens and their fearsome bucks, culminating in one of our biggest shows ever with the lucky folks of Red Wing, who have begged us by letter and telegram to return to them with our grand and formidable elephants who have adopted Kiki, our adorable baby hippo, straight from the mud baths of Africa. Our Lipizzaner horses led by the maestro Tip McCarthy, the greatest horseman of this century, bar none, are in our show under the banner of Showalter Spectacular Pyrotechnic Pageant. We've got shows and acts for everyone. Bring the old folks and let them gaze with rare delight upon the Forestina sisters, those queens of the air, with their amazing acrobatics. Husbands, bring your wives. Ladies, bring the menfolk. And you can all enjoy our show of the Golden Orient, starring a bevy of beauties never seen before. Culture, uplift, and that ain't all. What you think, girlie? He said. Gonna get your ma and pa to bring you and the rest of the clan to see us in Brookings? That's our last stop here in sunny South Dakota. I told him I didn't have parents, and I was headed for Chicago. No parents, he said. How you getting by? I told him, a little stiffly, that I got by, and he waved a hand at me. I'm not asking about your general welfare. You look like a big, smart girl. I figure you know your stuff. Bet you know how to take shorthand. I nodded. Mrs. O'Neill had an old book of the Pittman system from when she'd been a secretary, and when Mr. O'Neill worked late and the babies were asleep, we did practice together. I could write a short letter. And you look to me to be 18, which you would have to be to take me up on the offer I'm making you now. To join Showalter's show of shows, the Etoile du Nord Traveling Circus, of which I am only a humble representative and the advance man, Lucius P. Wilson. He made a little bow. I bobbed down and did not say, I am almost 14 years old and I got $1 in my pocket. Am I right about you? You got a head for figures and you can read and write real well? And can you type, sister? I said I could, which was a lie. But I had seen pictures of people using typewriters, and I knew my alphabet, and I was a demon speller. I am a demon speller, I said. I'm never wrong, Mr. Wilson said. You got a hairbrush or something like it? I put my hand up automatically, and I lowered it. I was being 18 now. I knew shorthand, and I could type now. I was a valuable commodity. And this was a man with thinning blonde hair and a sharp suit with grease spots on the lapel. I can smarten up, I said. He grinned at me. All right. Can you lose the hat? Smile a little, that'll be swell. If you just can't, and folks ask you why you look so goddamn downhearted, say your mother was Melina, the Lion Queen, and she was mauled to death only last week by one of her own tigers. Oh, looky here, ladies and gentlemen. He said, that's a smile. We got out at Tyndall, which was a bigger town than Bodle, bigger than Aberdeen, and therefore to me, a proper city. A man in a Model T drove us to the edge of a wide brown field, spread out for acres and flat as a tabletop. We got out. I saw pennants and gold-fringed banners being hoisted up, huge white canvas squares, each the size of a roof lying on the ground, being pulled up by men in undershirts and loose green pants and high work boots. Yards of dirty rope, like giant garter snakes, lay coiled everywhere. A blonde woman in a man's jacket and dirty white tights and white boots led two dusty Palomino horses across the field. A pair of dark-haired girls walked past with belts of gold fringe around their waist and gold clips shining in their hair. Each with a monkey in a gold fringe vest, sitting on her shoulder, screaming while the girls walked and talked. Men unloaded horses, dogs, pigs, and an elephant, red-eyed and slow. A man in overalls fed the elephants handfuls of hay as they walked together. More men wrestled with canvas tents, wires, and pulleys. It was like the inside of a grand clock, sweat and swearing making the gears go round. Red and blue wagons lined the perimeter, their steps thrown down, their shutters closed against the heat. I smelled overcooked vegetables and frying meat, the smell of a farm dinner. I must have looked orphaned. Lucius poked me. We can go by the cookhouse later, he said, but you gotta start work today. I'm behind. He hit me on the fanny, and I took no notice. We walked straight to his wagon, which was two rooms with a narrow door between them. This here's reception, he said. Someone comes, you knock on my door, and you say, Mr. Wilson, and you tell me who it is, and I come out. I sat down on one of the chairs, with my hands in my lap, pulling on the brim of my hat. Mr. Wilson took my hat away from me. I'm burning this, he said. We worked in the reception room all afternoon. I sorted papers, filed receipts and bills, and wrote down the names of all the town officials and businessmen and the police officers of every town we'd be going to. He said that he was glad to have a smart and serious girl in the office, and that he felt sure there was nothing about me or my person that was going to bring drama or lunacy to Showalter's, for which he personally would be grateful. I said, you mean you didn't bring me here to be in the Cooch show? Good one, he said. He said I had no cause to worry. No one was going to let me actually handle money. He said I was going to live in a wagon with two other girls and to not make trouble. I'll make an effort, I said. I liked being 18. We ate our fried beef pies in the reception area. Men were still working outside by electric light. He said I'd be bunking with Betsy the Lobster Girl, who was a good girl who got tired of bunking with her parents, the Lobster Man and Lady, And you got Marianne, the alligator girl, he said. A smartass. He told me that Showalter's freaks. They called themselves freaks, he said. Nothing wrong with that. Came from every part of the country where people put their not-right children in attics and root cellars and haylofts. There were freaks from Alabama and Mississippi, which you'd expect, he said, but also from New Jersey and Pennsylvania. Mr. Wilson said, Western Pennsylvania was a gold mine. We got Legless Louie there and Dimple's Delight. He said that Mr. Showalter still drove up to people's houses if he heard they had a freak in the family, or he'd be driven by Lucius Wilson himself, who'd paved the way, a Bible in one hand and a contract in his pocket. Sometimes, the parents beg you to take their kid, to give the kid a chance. Sometimes, he said, the kids beg you, so they don't have to live out their days in the cellar. He handed me a flour sack for my things. The girl's wagon was a tidy navy blue, with white scalloped trim around the windows. It looked like a school dress in a catalog. Mr. Wilson knocked, and we waited at the bottom of the stairs. I heard their voices and quick steps to the door. The alligator girl let us in. She was in a green terry bathrobe and shorter than me, covered with a thick, bumpy hide, exactly like a pink alligator. The rough, uneven skin ran up most of her face and around her eyes, like a mask. She stood with a book in one hand, and when she saw me, she sat back on her bed and began to read furiously. Her roommate, the lobster girl, was small and pretty, with hands fused into large pink claws. She was whitening her shoes like a regular girl. I ducked not to bang my head getting in the little wagon. I saw two built-in bunks on opposite sides, like pictures I'd seen of ship's quarters, and a folding cot with a green blanket between them, for me. I stood there, holding my flour sack. "Well, aren't you Gulliver among the Lilliputians?" the alligator girl said. "Plus, you have a flour sack." The lobster girl laughed and said, "Geez, Marianne, she can't help it if she's not a shrimp like us." Mr. Wilson bowed and walked out, saying, "This here is Lorena Hickok. She's working in the front office, so mind your manners." I had nothing to change into, and the two of them watched me sit on the end of the cot. Both of them were deformed and disfigured, and probably not even safe out in the wide world. But at Showalter's, Etoile du Nord, we faced off as three teenage girls. The other two had real beds, and shampoo, and toothpaste, and they were the right size for this wagon, and I was odd man out. "Do you have night clothes?" Marianne, the alligator girl, said, and I shook my head. Marianne said, "Nothing I have would fit you." She held up two small pink nightgowns. "How about you, Betsy?" she said. Betsy said, with great kindness, "You can sleep in your underclothes, Lorena. Tomorrow, I'll tell Miss Paula that you could use a few things. There'll be something. There always is." "I guess," Marianne said. "You're big. I always wanted to have a bit more presence. But can one desire too much of a good thing? That's from As You Like It." "Jiminy, Marianne," Betsy said. "Who cares? Sleep tight, Lorena. Dream of handsome men." She giggled, and I thought we could be friends. I put my clothes and my socks on my cot and stood there in my shabby underwear, in agony. "We're not modest," Marianne said. "What's the point? I mean, c'est pourquoi?" I said goodnight. I would have picked up that Marianne was an educated girl, even if she didn't have a leather set of Shakespeare on the shelf over her bed. She saw me looking. "Do you adore Shakespeare?" she said. I didn't answer right away. I had never used the word adore in my life. Marianne sighed and pulled up her blanket. "Welcome to the wagon, Lorena." Marianne put out the lamp over her bed, and Betsy did the same. I lay in the dark for a long time, crying into the flat pillow and looking out the window over Betsy's bunk. Men were moving around. I saw the firefly ends of their cigarettes. In the morning, both girls were gone. Beds made, towels hung up. Mr. Wilson knocked on the wagon door. He picked up a couple of donuts for us and said that probably I needed a bigger breakfast, but it would have to wait because he was behind in everything. Miss Paula, the costume manager, had been and gone, leaving behind a pair of patch men's trousers with a thick belt, a pair of what Mr. Wilson called Turkish slippers, shoes with the satin toes curled up and the sole very thin, and a soft, clean men's shirt. I changed and took dictation in my bare feet to save my slippers, sitting under an old sign that said, "Delight, entertain, mystify," making notes while Mr. Wilson read off the lists of who to bribe and tindle for tomorrow's show. He handed me a cup of coffee. I wasn't going to Chicago. Just yet. Or to high school. Or to find my kind Aunt Ella. This here was an adventure. A big man with a pointed beard stuck his head in. Mr. Wilson jumped up. "Mr. Showalter, sir."
"Jerry heard about the new girl. He has an idea. Send the greenie over there."
I looked up, and the big man walked out. Mr. Showalter did not address people like me directly. Mr. Wilson walked me across the field.
"Hey, sunshine, I brought a friend, Miss Lorena Hickok."
A wiry, dark-haired man sat outside his wagon, lathering his face in front of a hand mirror and shouting,
"She's gonna shake, she's gonna bake, she's gonna scorch your eyes and then bait them with her beauty. How you doing, Lucius? How you doing, kid?"
One of the smaller banners, purple, yellow, red, and blue, with star and moon shapes punched out and gold fringe along the edges, hung on the side of their wagon, and they'd strung fairy lights around the windows and along the roof. A man came out in a flowered silk wrapper and dungarees stuffed into his boots. He was tall and slim. His hair was cut regular style on one side and pinned up like a woman's on the other.
"I'm Jerry," he said.
He kissed my hand and said, "Brother and sister in one body." Sonny said, "I'm Sonny Florin, Ballyhoo. Jer, you're not thinking of her for the cooch." Jerry caught my eye to say, "Stand up straight." And I did, even though I agreed with the other man. I could just see me clumping around on the stage and nothing much while a bunch of men who looked like my father made remarks.
"You never know," Jerry said. "You remember Bertil? Some men like a big girl. She's got nice eyes."
"You're the boss," Sonny said. Mr. Wilson waved to us and went back to his office, his hair bright in the sun, his suit shining.
"Stay for supper," one of the men said.
By the time we brought plates and bottles and platters to the picnic table, Alligator Girl, Mary Ann, and Lobster Girl, Betsy, had come over in their linen shifts and felt slippers, with a bunch of wildflowers and a milk bottle for the table. Jerry sat between Betsy and me. I watched to see who was going to help Betsy with the chicken and the dumplings, the size of my fist. I tried not to make a fool of myself, staring at her fused fingers, tight around the fork and knife and sawing away.
"You getting used to us?"
Jerry said. He ran a finger up my arm.
"Oh, you got the heebie-jeebies?"
He put chicken and potato salad on my plate. I ate my chicken as quietly as I could, trying not to make any big gestures or knock over my water glass or demonstrate that I was unfit to be there.
"Here's what you need to know," Jerry said. "Every rube thinks they're better than we are, and every freak knows the truth. It's us who are just plain better than them."
"I don't think I'm better than anyone," I said.
"Believe me, I don't."
Marianne patted my arm kindly. "He doesn't mean you in particular," she said. "He's speaking in general, and in general, people come to us to be horrified or amused or both and even more just to feel better. These are poor people scraping by in one-horse towns hoping for electricity. Like if you're fat with a pretty face,
you're mourning your fate, and then God is kind enough to put you in front of a fat girl with a mustache and a port wine birthmark. We're a comfort, we are. God's conspicuous errors.
Isn't she something?
Betsy said. Marianne could have gone to college. She could have taught college.
Not too late,
Jerry said, and Marianne tossed her head like she had a head full of curls instead of what she had, which was a plaid newsie cap on top of her poor, scaly, almost hairless scalp. Jerry bowed to her. Betsy said, we're not deaf, you know. We hear what they say. Oh, mumble, mumble, look at her arms. Look at his little titty. They must think once you're on stage, your ears just close up. And we see them, too. We see them, and I'm telling you, these people, they don't know nothing. The worst of us are still better than rubes.
Amen, Jerry said.
He put down his wine glass and did a little tap dance on the wooden deck. Jerry said, Lorraine and I are taking a walk. We walked past the edge of the wagons toward the animals. He held my hand. I don't think the cooch is right for you. Because I'm plain, I said, and I'm too big. You need to cut that shit out, he said. You're not plain, and big's no problem. You got men out there who'd love to bounce on top of you, firm young thing that you are. Lucius Wilson, maybe. Don't you worry. He kissed me on the cheek. I never made any money till I took my pants off, sweetheart. I'm not saying you have to go that way. Every week we packed up and moved on, from Tyndall to Plankton to Lake Preston and then Tracy, Minnesota, where the Rousties added dream catchers with red and blue streamers and Indian headdresses to the decorations. I got up every morning with Marianne and Betsy. The girls folded me into their morning routine. Marianne was the most disfigured and the smartest and the cruelest. With long sleeves and stuffed mittens or gloves on, Betsy could go out in the world. Betsy and I gave Marianne all the privacy we could. Betsy had me brush her hair, which she could do, but not easily, and it gave us both something to pay attention to while Marianne undressed and dressed. Betsy's hair was beautiful, in the freak show manner, Marianne said. You highlight the deformity, she said. She modeled for us, like she was selling gowns at Marshall Fields. She held one hard, pink, completely scaled arm up, and traced its pretty curve with her other, equally awful-looking hand. She kept her wrist high and her hands tilted, like a showgirl. She put both hands on her small waist, leaning forward. The only place without scales was the bridge of her nose and her upper lip. But you also want to point out the ways in which we are not deformed. She squeezed her small waist even tighter, and then she pulled Betsy's long braid. The two of them sat on their bunks to watch me change out of my nightgown, which belonged to the office lady who left, and then get dressed. The watching seemed fair to all of us. I stood at the foot of my bed and pulled the nightgown over my head. I stood there in just my knickers, looking like who I was, a good-sized girl from South Dakota who could churn butter and, if I was lucky enough to be somewhere that had a healthy cow, help any farmer deliver a calf. Marianne was looking for flaws, but Betsy just cupped her breasts and looked at mine. You really do have a very nice chest, she said. I put on my camisole and tightened the ribbons a little. I knew it was bad manners to rush. I blushed and put on my shoes while they waited, and the three of us walked out through the wagons, our arms entwined.
Everyone's liking you, Jerry said.
I was kneading his shoulders before his rehearsal. He said I had strong hands and he could use the help. He said singing and dancing as both sexes made for a goddamn demanding show. We did tug-of-war with a towel to loosen him up. Then I sat down beside him and helped him pull his knee to his ear. He stood up, shaking out his arms and legs, told me to stand completely still, or else he'd clip me in the mouth. He swung one leg up on my shoulder. He dropped his head back and bent his whole torso away from me, Both hands landed on the floor, and he rested his right foot on my right shoulder. I could smell the chalk and sweat and a sharp, fruity cologne from his tights.